Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Welcome, everyone. Good evening. My name is Rowan Conway. I'm Director of Innovation and Development here at the RSA, and I'm delighted to welcome you all here for this special event, the 2018 Bicentenary Medal Award. This Bicentenary Medal was instituted in 1954 to commemorate the founding of the Society over 200 years earlier and has been awarded annually for outstanding contribution to the advancement of design and industry in society. In the RSA's current account of design, the medal is awarded to an individual who has used design to great effect as an instrument of civic innovation. Recent past recipients include Dr. Andrea Seidmock for the application of design principles in policymaking, and Susan Woodward for innovative urban development strategies. So we're really delighted to award this year's medal to Deanna Van Buren. Deanna is a co-founder and design director for Designing Justice and Designing Spaces, an architecture and real estate development company which engages community in the design and development of new buildings, spaces, and tools to attack the root causes of mass imprisonment. Deanna and her team are using restorative models to inform the design of justice spaces in radically different ways, and we're looking forward to hearing more about the power of place in promoting social justice, and the tools and processes that designers can use to create meaningful systemic change. Here at the RSA, we're really interested in how we can direct design methods towards pressing social challenges by developing rich systemic understanding of a challenge that designers can exploit entrepreneurial opportunities for change. And I'm sure you'll see from Deanna's work that it's incredibly entrepreneurial in its methods. Deanna Van Buren's Bicentenary Medal Lecture is part of a special series of events to celebrate the opening of our new Enlightenment Coffee House downstairs in Rothmills, a space designed to stimulate creative thinking and collaborative action in the need to drive the kinds of change that we'll be talking about today. So let me move on to the medal presentation, which is from the Royal Mint. Says, don't drop it. It is also Deanna's birthday today, so we want to say happy birthday, Deanna. So we are giving the 2018 Bicentenary Medal for your pioneering efforts to transform the justice through design. And we're really looking forward to hearing more about your work. We also would like to welcome you to your honorary life fellowship of the RSA, so you can never leave. And there it is, which I will let you hold it here.
Get out. No, okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you. What up?
Can everyone hear me okay? Oh, look, the mic's working beautifully. I am so excited and grateful and honored to receive this award from the RSA. And I have to say, equally as exciting is to be invited into this community with you. I mean, I think we know that as we're trying to make transformative change, social change, raise consciousness, and my favorite part of the mission, take action, it can't be done outside of community, right? It can't be done with others. And you're my people. I need you. We sort of need to be working in community to do this together. So I'm deeply, deeply grateful to be invited in. Thank you. Thank you so much. And to that end, what I would like to talk a little bit about today is the system that we are trying to address. I'll tell you a little bit about my journey to get there and then some of the prototypes that we're developing, because they really are our prototypes for replication because they're relatively new and have a series of layers that we're trying to figure out every day, all the time, and hopefully ongoing with you. So this is the start of my sort of awareness of the inequity of some of our society's ills. And it started as just a little girl. You know, we and my family desegregated a small community in rural Virginia, coming out of the Jim Crow South, right, the apartheid of the United States, so someone here is not like the other ones. And my family was very clear that, you know, the society that we're in is changing, but it's just not equitable for black women. Like, you're going to be really struggling. And one of the systems that I was very clear was going to be difficult, and what I was told by my father to really stay out of, is the criminal justice system. Like, don't get a divorce. Like, just don't go near this one. And he said it every time we passed the Stafford County Courthouse, this building. So in my mind, justice became sort of manifested in this building type, in this piece of architecture, the stress and anxiety I felt in this society, and particularly around this particular issue. And it wasn't hard for me to leave Stafford, and I went on to become an architect, and I went to architecture school, and I actually started my professional career here in London with this gentleman. Eric Kuhn of Eric Kuhn and Associates. And what Eric taught me was that I could be passionate and emotional about architecture, that I could really express myself. He also supported me, gave me incredible amounts of responsibility when nobody would. He passed away 2 years ago. I would hope you don't mind. I'd like to dedicate this talk to him because I really would not be standing here today if it had not been for him and his support and belief in what I was doing. He'd be a little proud of me today. And so I loved working with Eric, but ultimately I was still working for developers. I was working for the wealthy and the powerful all over the world and in the Bay Area, designing shopping centers and commercial real estate. I did that for like 16 years, a long time. And what I found was that there was a real values misalignment. I was seeing more and more inequity, and I was seeing architects and planners doing nothing about it. I didn't see people that looked like me. I wanted to make a difference with my work. I wanted to be serving 100% of my community. And so I did something I do not recommend. I quit, but I had no money. I quit with no money. I had $5,000 in my account, and then I did the thing my dad told me not to do. I dove into this system. I dove right into this. Mass incarceration in the United States. Most of you may know that we incarcerate more of our citizens than any country in the entire world. You can see where the United Kingdom is here. You can see where we are. We have 7 million of our citizens under carceral control. That means they're in prison, they're on probation, or they're on parole. We are also disinvesting in communities, right? So we don't pay for education, but we pay to incarcerate people. And our prisons have become a kind of a warehouse for the mentally ill, for youth transitioning out of foster care. And it's essentially a disaster primarily for low-income communities of color that have been historically disinvested and completely incarcerated generation after generation. It's destroying their families and it's destroying their neighborhoods. We've been participating in this as urban planners and designers through various strategies over time, redlining, urban renewal, the wiping out of communities and moving them, freeways, splitting communities in half during white flight. And we have been building totally inappropriate infrastructure for thriving and the livelihood of these communities as we disinvested. And then, of course, there's the architecture. This is the role that, as an architect, the role that we've been playing is to build the infrastructure that adjudicates and that punishes, and that represents the values of that system, one that's hierarchical, patriarchal. There's sort of seen in the massing of the architecture, the materiality of the architecture, where it's located in the city. At every level, it's representing a system that is unequal to most. Works for some, not for all, but I was looking at a system I wanted to change and not understanding what do you do when you're confronted with a wall like this. That building better versions of these is not the solution to moving forward. And I think you start by asking a question. You're going to see me ask a lot of questions in this. What do I do? And then you hope for a miracle. And then I got one. And it was a voice telling me about restorative justice. Has anyone in the room heard of restorative justice? Yay! So many. Should I explain it anyway? Maybe just real quick. So restorative justice is a philosophy that says when a crime has been committed, it is essentially a breach of relationship, and that the needs of those who have been harmed are the first thing that we need to think about. Those must be taken care of. And that those who have committed the offense have an obligation to make amends. And that these parties, anyone impacted by the crime, comes together in some very intense meetings and circles to address the harm and create a plan to address the offender's conduct. And so these are being used in schools, they're being used in many at cities levels. DAs and district attorneys are diverting cases out of court into restorative justice. And what we're finding is that survivors of violence have lower rates of PTSD. We have 70% less violent reoffending. It's actually great for violent offenses. And it's being used in everything from those down to spraying graffiti. And so I started to think, well, why aren't we designing for that system? As easily as we could be designing for punitive justice, how do we design to amplify restorative justice in our communities? And I did something that I'm sure the RSA would not advocate for. I decided I was going to do it by myself in my own little room and think about what this stuff might look like. And I was fortunately invited by a colleague, a social worker, restorative justice practitioner, Dr. Barb Taves, who said, you know, Deanna, why don't we actually talk to those most impacted by crime? Why don't we start to explore what a restorative justice architecture and design looks like with those who are incarcerated and those who have been most impacted by the crime, given that 95%, sometimes 100% in the communities I've been working in, of those who are incarcerated are also survivors of violence. So we created a toolkit called the Designing Justice Toolkit, and you can use it. People are using it all over the world now at www.designingjustice.com. It's a free curriculum that looks at exploring the intersection of restorative justice and design in high security settings. What it does is it promotes creative expression. It's a research tool. We use it a lot for that. It promotes wellness. And you can start to work with groups who are incarcerated using basic architecture tools. It's just a series of folding and ripping of paper. And what we started to find is that folks we're working with had incredible vision. They had amazing ideas, things I never would have thought of. It was transformative for me. It was transformative for the work. We were teaching them how to do qualitative interviews, how to work in groups for the first time, how to communicate to each other. And the ideas that they were coming up with are inspiring the work that we continue to do. And then another thing also happened is that through just this sort of envisioning of spaces for restorative justice, the envisioning of spaces to address the harm that you may have caused, people were accessing trauma, and in the workshops we were starting to cry and starting to process. I was not prepared for that. I had to end up getting additional training outside of my architecture training to be responsible, to hold space for that type of thing. But what does that tell you, right? What does that tell you that just envisioning it, what happens if we actually make it? Right now, we're working with Adovo out of Chicago to translate that into a digital curriculum so we can go from working with hundreds of incarcerated people a year to thousands. And we use this on many, many projects that we are still doing. And so I felt at the time like we had enough information to begin to start to create things, and we started to focus on diversion from prison and jail. How do we keep people from ever going into the institution at all? And it also started to initiate something we call the program in place model. We think this is really important, that as you're developing the program, you are also doing the architecture at the same time. It's not in response to, it's with. And we started with the Center for Court Innovation out of New York. And what they were doing was bringing Native American peacemaking practices into a non-Native community, the United States, for the very first time. And so what I was able to do was work with them that while they were training judges and prosecutors on which cases to divert, these were quality of life crimes, right? So someone grabs your purse, steals your car. I was starting to run peacemaking circles. I got trained as a circle keeper, so I was able to both support my client through training people in the community on how to do circle process while I got aesthetic input on what a peacemaking center should look like. Has anyone ever been in a peacemaking center? We have one. I had never been in one at all, and I had no idea what they look like. It was critical, this process. It was incredibly powerful. We were really able to start to develop a set of design guidelines on what these should be like. Also, on our website, you can have if you want to be making some peacemaking centers. We need them a lot. And what we did was we helped them to both locate neutral territory in the community where the peacemaking center could be, and as they were training elders in the community to navigate and to facilitate these processes, we adaptively reused an old drug house in the community to become a peacemaking center, first in the United States for this type. And what they found is that in the first year they wanted to do 20 cases, they actually did over 80 cases. And part of why it was successful was that people were coming here and they were understanding like, oh, this is a different kind of justice. And that it was the space that was convincing them to engage in the process. So the space was actually amplifying the effects of the program. So we looked around us at that time and were excited about the impact that this sort of small early project was happening, but we needed to amplify the work and we needed to expand the work. There was just too many problems happening, particularly around the criminal justice system. And so we started to look at two new things in relationship to the work to address the mass incarceration issue. One was, how do we design to address restorative economics? That the economic issues at play were, in addition, easily as great as some of the justice issues that we were seeing. The second thing we need to do was, how do we amplify the work? Like, how do we do this faster and more and expand? And that started to come through in an envisioning and a process that we've begun called the Restorative Justice City Reinvestment Tool. So this is a citywide look. So as we're looking at the micro, we have to be looking at the macro. And the Restorative Justice City Reinvestment Tool is a project we're doing in both Oakland and in Detroit. And what it does is it helps community to gather grassroots data around various things, public safety, education in their community, and it tracks it over macro level data at the scale of the city, so various every sector that we can think of, and combines them into a digital tool. It's an app and an online platform that will help cities plan for decarceration. As we start to move dollars out of emergency care, how do we move dollars out of the criminal justice system, where do they need to be reinvested, and have that be a community-driven a tool that they can use and very transparent. We began this in Oakland, working with police officers, restorative justice leaders, community groups, the county, local citizens, to start to understand that in Oakland we needed a corridor of resources in the flatlands where the lowest income folks in our community live. And this is a distributed network of restorative justice hubs that are tied to schools and housing. We also developed a set of action domains, 7 action domains of what the restorative justice city needs to have and signals that that's already happening. And I'll run you through some of those and just show you 3 projects related to the restorative justice city, because this process is already yielding real-world projects. It's an incredible thing to see. And the first is facilitating restorative dialogue. I'm very passionate about this. I truly believe that designers and architects need to be working in the public realm to address historical legacies of violence. I cannot think of a culture that is not grappling with that. In the United States, it's slavery. And we start to see and look at models of that already where people can grieve and people can come together in dialogue, whether it's the Philadelphia Mural Project, where a victim and offender are coming together to create public art, the Vietnam War Memorial, a place of grieving. We, of course, now have the Lynching Museum in the United States, Christopher Dishko's work in Northern Ireland, where he's projecting conversations onto the walls and people are talking for the first time. This is where the bulk of my personal artistic practice will be moving into next year. It's critical that we figure out, I believe, and use this tool for change. Another piece is the breaking of the city to healing the city. And this is particularly around designing for impact. And not just designing the aesthetic and beautiful places that we like to create, but designing the program and designing the financial models and how those two integrate. So a project that will be completed in 4 months is Restore Oakland. Restore Oakland is the first built project to come out of the Restorative Justice City Investment Tool and is the country's first center in the United States for restorative justice and restorative economics. And we helped 2 nonprofits to buy the building as real estate developers, and then we gutted the building, and we're turning it into 3 things in this community. The first is a restaurant, a social justice restaurant, that breaks the racial divide in the restaurant industry by training low-wage restaurant workers to get living wage jobs and fine dining, including formerly incarcerated people. On the second floor, we have a community organizing facilities for the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights and tenant and immigrant rights groups where they'll be able to organize and push movements forward. And then we will also have the county's first dedicated spaces for restorative justice so they can double their caseload, being able to divert young people ages 15 to 25 out of court and into restorative justice in Alameda County. The good news is not only will it be done soon, but we've already moved out of the planning process to do another model in Detroit. So the replication of this type of infrastructure is starting to happen. A jail costs $300 million. One of these facilities costs 20 to 25, right? So we can start to do the math on what the impact is from that. Another prototype we're working on is around the hybridizing of justice in the restorative justice city. And what we mean by that is that the justice infrastructure we have has to be re-envisioned in a different way. Not the prisons and jails, but other types of infrastructure that exist, like reentry housing, like spaces for probation and parole. Reentry is now become one of the primary points at which we're coming into the work. And part of that is really around dignified and wraparound and supportive and transitional housing. And so something that we're starting to do is we like to stack functions. That's sort of a biophilic term of stacking the functions. Like you do one thing and it does 8 things. And so what we started to do is work with Black churches in the United States. Black churches are cash poor and asset rich. Their congregations are diminishing, but they have all this land. And they also have social capital. Because the thing about reentry housing is that when people come back to their communities, you get a little bit of NIMBYism. Do you have NIMBYism in the UK? Not in my backyard. I know you do because I've experienced it. But yes, it's there. And it can shut down a project fast, right? So we need this infrastructure, but people don't want it there. Even though the data shows that when you have it there, the communities become safer. They don't become less safe. So the Black church has that social capital. They have the assets. And so it makes sense they're able to integrate folks back into the community and help the community to know who's coming and to receive them. And so one of the things we've started to do is something called the concept development process through our concept development fund. And what it does is it works with communities around an aesthetic model, right? So a vision for the project, but it also looks at financial modeling at the same time. It also looks at the policy implications of the work and the program all at once so that by the end, they have a plan for the project that they can take to investors, that they can take to lenders, and so that we help them really manifest the project. We've just completed that process. We're starting and onboarding three more. And this project will be a reentry facility for 40 men. It will have wraparound services for them, classrooms, spaces for therapy, drug and alcohol addiction services, a gym, and we'll take, the church is the one on the right, and we'll take an old schoolhouse building, two schoolhouse buildings, and turn them into this facility that also will have social enterprise embedded into it. So there'll be a cafe where they can be trained. The church also makes money off of this effort in that they are already selling goods there. They're working out of there. It's a front-facing facility for the community. It becomes a mixing bowl for these communities starting to come together. We're also working on something we called living pods. These are spaces for the men to have safe, to feel safe and have privacy. Often reentry housing, you have 10 men in a room, 15 men in a room, or women. These are small pods that will bring not only privacy to them, but we're designing it with them, and they will also be learning digital fabrication on site as a workforce development strategy and making these as well, right? So you stack the functions all the way down from the plan, the overall plan, down to the piece of furniture. That is how deep the work needs to go in order to facilitate and have power in some of these prototypes. So the last project I'll show you within the context of the Restorative Justice City Reinvestment Initiative is from surviving to being your best self, right? We want people to not just be getting basic services, but to really be thriving. And that these are access to resources, social services, and that they're co-created with people. It's not top-down, it's bottom-up. And this is nearby where I live in San Francisco. And you have to imagine, like, this is a housing development near where I live, and right nearby is Apple and Google, right down the road. And just in this bubble, there are no accesses to resources. How are people supposed to thrive when there are incredible amounts of barriers? And those barriers are hundreds of years old. The disinvestment means there's no public transport. They can't get to the services. People do not have a car. You know, how do you take care of your children and then get downtown to go see your probation officer if you have to, or go to see the doctor? Those things are not here. Fresh produce, these are food deserts in Detroit, school deserts. There's gang territory issues. It's not safe for me to cross the street. And so this is what places look like. And so our response has been a project called the Pop-Up Resource Village. And this is an incredibly complex project. This is more complex than any other project we have in the office. We've had to hire a community organizer on staff. I think they're the only architecture firm I know with that. We have an operations staff, because what it is it's a village, a mobile village, a village on wheels that brings a constellation of services to communities and activates blighted sites around the Bay Area. And so for our piece of it, we are trying to make things, right? So we are making stuff that facilitate the village. We're making pop-up shops to support micro-entrepreneurs popping up and actually use design to help them sell on site in our village. We're providing a framework or container for them. We create all kinds of mobile resources that help beautify the space and make it more accessible so the community can come and feel nourished and well in an environment where they can relax. Oh, whoops, we're also taking buses. And we're taking municipal buses, and we're turning them into a variety of resources. This is the School on Wheels. It is a classroom that brings GED and high school education into communities specifically for formerly incarcerated men and women and their community of care, but for anyone in the village. It can hold up to 15 students and a teacher, and is fully fitted out with all the technology required. And the goal is it will serve another 3,000 students per year, and it will anchor the village. And we have programming on this every time the village pops up. We also have a vehicle soon to be complete. It's under construction now, which is the Women's Mobile Refuge vehicle. And this is a vehicle that operates 24 hours a day. It's outside of the jails at night, where they release women from jail in the middle of the night. We just lost a woman the other day. That's another story about why they're doing that, but this is going to be there for them as a place of refuge at night, and we're also working on having it be a mobile refuge for victims of sex trafficking. And during the day, what it does is it anchors the village as resources for women. So we worked with about 60 incarcerated women to develop the design of this. Also started to develop textiles with them, which I was able to fabricate, and then they are now using those textiles to build out and design the interiors of the vehicle. The vehicle will have 24-hour social worker and caseworker on there, so they can come, they can rest, they can contact their families, they can get a change of clothes, they can get a counseling session. But it's a small but impactful project that's anchoring both our village and really supporting women in the community. And so there's really, I mean, I can show you slides, but I want to just show you a quick video of the project and start to end there. And my colleague who is doing the AV was going to put that on for me, so. So that's our village. You have to come, it's really great. I love going to it myself. So I'll end with just the last couple slides. We are finding that these few things I've showed you are just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the infrastructure that we need to decarcerate. Some things we're working on now are restorative justice schools. What does a whole school look like if restorative justice is a primary way of addressing harm in the school? We're working on a concept called creating home, which is customized housing for youth transitioning out of foster care, because we have about 80% of those who are incarcerated have had some experience with our foster care system. We're doing a video game to help youth de-escalate prior to a restorative justice process. And what's great is we're starting to have many projects come into the office about transforming existing justice infrastructure that is becoming defunct as we finally start to decarcerate. So I hope that you will join me in our efforts to see this transition. I know that England is in the UK is committed to doing this. And I think, you know, together globally, if we can start to look at all of the infrastructure we need to decarcerate and all the ways we can move forward, it really can be done. So thank you so much. Thank you for the honor and thank you for being a community with me.
So I'll come and join you on the stage.
Here, I'll move over. I'll slide.
Thank you so much. There's so much in that and so much inspiration. I want to really thank you again for bringing such a powerful story and thinking so deeply as you do about the whole and not just what design looks like and its interpretation, but actually what this means for community and what it means for society. As you described, your work is uncommon practice. It may become, one hopes, the new normal, but it's not currently the normal, especially in kind of urban design practice or the work. And I think it seems to me that Eric Kuhn was a bit of a pioneer, or maybe a bit of a maverick in his time of saying, go on, go and talk to people outside of the discipline. I love the concept of a restorative justice city, and I think that really chimes with some of we've been working in criminal justice at the RSA for over sort of nearly 10 years. And we have a project called Transitions, which is it has an ambition, but actually needs to learn some of the actual tools and projects that you've worked with. I'm really interested about what the implications are for designers. What do they have to learn and what do they have to unlearn? You talked about needing to bring on additional training for trauma, for understanding how to be trained as a circle keeper, you know, and then learning how to do reinvestment tools, so really understanding the language of development. What did you have to learn to be able to do your practice, and what do you think needs to happen in broader design education to change to accommodate this kind of work?
I'll start with the broader design education. It's only just started in the U.S. I mean, I don't know if it's happening here, but what we're realizing is that a lot of young people coming out of school want to do this kind of work, and they're professionals who want to do this kind of work. And there is some cultural training that's required. There needs to be some awareness on white supremacy within the context of that and privilege. As you're moving into communities that do not look like you, that you have not been interfacing with, There is a lot of need to look at one's ego and the need to educate and to learn to listen more. And we do have programs now emergent in the U.S. that are doing that. They're very new. They're not embedded in one school. It's actually a program across many schools where students are going into that to learn how to do that. There's also an interesting publication that has also come out that help young people in particular and professionals learn how to work in communities of color or low-income communities that may not be a part of their cultural understanding. So it's a must. We have to do that.
No, absolutely. And that's really interesting to see how it was interesting to see that you've created an open source toolkit and how much we can actually share these things more widely so that practice changes more quickly. I'm also interested in public art and your the way that you talked about public art there was really interesting, because there's often a debate about whether art, public art is, you know, for the beneficiary, you know, the beneficiaries of the community, we will do some nice piece of sculpture and everyone will be happier. Or if it's community collaboration and you create art by the community. Sure. And what's really interesting about what you're talking about is that public art can play a role in change and be a signal of change, but that there's an interesting bridging space between the artist and the community. And we had Morag Myerskoff here last week talking specifically about belonging and public art and her role in change. Can you talk more about how you see public art as driving systemic change?
You know, in the US we have all these public art memorials that are like Civil War memorials, right? They speak to a historical legacy that is painful for many. Mm. And I don't know if you've seen, people are starting to take them down. And so I think there's an opportunity, there's this gap there around which a dialogue can happen. And my hope is that I'm currently participating with a group of black folks and white folks in the U.S. to address the historical legacies of slavery through dialogue. So it's my own personal commitment to restorative justice. And together we are talking about the development of a new kind of memorial that would come out of that dialogue. So I'm curious about how public art, the creation of public art, is actually tied into a process that begins to represent something new and a different future that we want to share together. And it seems to me that the public realm is the perfect place to be doing that kind of work.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that plays to that, the elements of creative placemaking in this. You're talking about leaving a legacy, a creative legacy through this work. So it's not just a visible mural, but actually the holistic way of thinking. I very much took from your talk this kind of a thread of moving from fear to hope and also recognizing and acknowledging polarization and, for example, the kind of personal traumas that people were experiencing. I'm interested in how the micro and the macro sit together. So when you're doing this work in Oakland, for example, how that plays out with the bigger dialogue that's happening on the political stage or a stronger sense of polarization. How do you create boundaries in this space so that it is a safe space, but it's also a real productive space? You're making change through this, even if things are happening in a different way outside.
Well, it's been challenging to navigate that. I mean, I was like, I'm just an architect. Like, everyone's like, what are you doing about the policy? It's like, well, you know, we talk to people about it, or we are meeting with people in a more discreet way to try to get things done. And it used to be that we could lay a bit lower. Like, there's a more, like, let's just try this over here because nobody's looking at us. Mm-hmm. But now people are looking more. And we are having to navigate the sort of political sphere in a city, right? So generally we're working at a city level, not always at a county level. And we're not working at a federal level at this time. So it requires us to really align ourselves, be clear about what our values are, really clear. And really what our objectives are, and align ourselves with the folks who are as close as possible. Mm-hmm. Understanding that actually I find infrastructure and infrastructure development, and thinking about this, can be a real way of bringing people together. Sometimes it can be less polarizing.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm gonna come to the put your hands up for questions. We have a mic in the back. We'll start with the lady here, then go to the table here, and then anyone else. So is the mic just on its way?
I'm sure I can be heard. I'd love to know what's stopping you.
Nothing.
So who do you, who says yes to all your wonderful projects and ideas?
So
because it's very different here.
Yeah, there's not much stopping us at the moment aside from capital, right?
Yeah.
Money.
Sure.
So the money piece is ever emergent. Right now, we are funded by philanthropic dollars significantly. We sometimes go to charitable organizations. We also go to social impact investors, are always of interest. Socially responsible lenders are also folks that we look at. There's a few of those, Enterprise Partners or LISC are in the names of some in the U.S. that we work with. We're also starting to look at investment through the opportunity zones, which have emerged in the United States, and then also blockchain and cryptocurrencies. Very few governmental dollars, right? So the goal, some of the longer-term strategies which we're working on is to get our tax dollars to pay for this stuff rather than for, you know, I try to tell people, like, well, your tax dollars paid for that prison. Is that what you want to pay for, or do you want to pay for these? So the Peacemaking Center was built from some federal money. We have this, like, little pot of innovation. Like, we spend $80 billion there, but there's this little pot for innovation. We got some of that.
But presumably for that Oakland project that you showed us, you had to go to the city to say, this is what we want, and then the government of the city... the government of the city must have been able must have said yes to it.
They did very little. They allowed it to get built, right?
So
I got planning permission. Yeah. Yes, okay. I got planning permission.
Okay.
And
huge problem in this country.
Yes, I know. Yeah, and it's a huge problem with certain size structures and in certain cities. This was a villain. Like, my partners were highly politically connected in the government, and so it made it a little easy for us to get this. I don't know if we'll be so lucky on the reentry campus, but I'm hoping so.
Although the opportunity zones is a very interesting new tax reform, which may enable that as well.
That was a really inspiring presentation.
Thank you.
You're working out of San Francisco, Oakland. Is anything happening in the other major cities of the United States?
Yes, so we have two projects in Detroit. We have another restorative justice hub in Detroit, and we also just launched the Restorative Justice City Reinvestment Tool project in Detroit. We've just started two new projects in New York City. One I'm not allowed to talk about yet, but I hopefully can talk about it later. And then the Restorative Justice Schools project and the video game project is going to be in New York. And we are soon to begin a project in Atlanta as we start to look at this sort of decommissioning of our jails and these justice. We have these huge justice hubs in a lot of our cities, and those are being defunct, and we're going to be starting there too. So we work nationally.
There's a really interesting thing. I'd like you to talk a little bit more about the kind of pop-up resource village. That was an incredible project, but we have many of the same problems around moving between social care as a child and then moving to adult social care, also things like reentry and probation that you had talked about. Could you tell us more about that transition phase? Like, how do you work with services specifically to bring people into those systems?
Well, you know, we are, again, I think people often look at us like, oh, so what's your program? I was like, well, we don't have a program. We are the placemaking people. So if with sort of transitional services or systems, we've gone to them. Like, we're often like, hey, what's happening? We go to them, we meet with them, we talk to them, and we start to help them identify what are the pain points that we can help you with, and how can we come in and facilitate some kind of infrastructure piece that will help you do your work more easily. And that is the example with Creating Home. First Place for Youth is an organization doing that work, or Five Key Schools and Programs, which is a partner on the Village who was having trouble getting access to their students once they left jail. We can be like, well, what about a mobile infrastructure? What about customized housing that the foster youth could actually be able to work at and live? So we start to work with them to begin to develop the infrastructure that they need. Mm-hmm. And that can be a multiple year process.
Yeah, improving through transitional spaces, which is interesting, how you can prove systems work on a pop-up level and then build it.
Yeah, and hopefully catalyze more permanent development. The women's mobile refuge trailer is already catalyzing the need and the desire for a women's resource center and an enhancement of that as a
which
project
is exactly
type.
What prototype should do.
Huh? Yeah.
There was someone in the table at the back there, so this lady here, and then there's another table there. And anyone over this side? Sorry, I can't see. So another one here. Yeah.
Say fantastic, and a lot of it resonates with what is happening here. I think we have a two problems. We have race and class, and I think a lot of the things that happen here are often thought of by people here, and they don't understand that actually the grassroots has the solution. So we do have Designing Out Crime at Central St Martin's, who are doing a huge amount of amazing work, but I would love to put you in touch with so many people who would value so much your contribution and what you're doing there, because we have the Forgiveness Project, Restorative Justice, Plays, but you seem to have linked them all. And that's what I think is totally brilliant. And also with funding, there are philanthropists here who will do things. There are designers and architects who are doing amazing things. But I think they're not joined up in the way that you've joined them up. Mm. And I think that is brilliant. And I've just come back from Detroit. And I just so wish I'd met you before I went. But I had grassroots guides who took me everywhere.
Right.
So I just wanted to say, absolutely, you've just given me so much inspiration.
Thank you.
That's all. I don't have a question even. So.
Oh, thank you.
We'll lean into you to the questions. The lady behind in the red jumper, thank you for that comment.
How receptive have you found criminal justice practitioners to restorative justice principles?
That's a good question. It varies. We of course try to find and locate the ones that are receptive to it, because you can't do any of these projects without it. I first started talking about this back in I delivered my first paper on this in 2009. At that time, people were not as receptive to it. Things have changed dramatically over this time, that people are becoming more and more receptive to it. It's easier when you talk about young people versus adults, right? So it just sort of depends on the group that you're talking about. DA, getting district attorneys and prosecutors to buy in is really helpful. But ultimately, restorative justice can operate outside of those systems if communities buy into it. And that is really the goal, is that you actually don't need to convince anybody in the criminal justice division to do that if it gets robust enough. But at the moment, the two systems need to start to talk to each other more, and they are starting to.
Something that leans also to that question, you had talked earlier, when we met earlier, around data points that you collect in order to prove the impacts of the work. Can you expand a little bit on what kind of data do you collect to prove the value, if put under that scrutiny?
Sure, yeah. Well, the pop-up Resource Village has three evaluators right now. We have two quantitative evaluators and a qualitative evaluator. We are evaluating the impact on the entrepreneurship piece, like are low-income entrepreneurs in the village making money? Are we circulating dollars in the community? Like people are, because often in communities of color, the dollar lasts like a few hours before it leaves the community. So we're tracking that. We're looking at how it's helping local shops and other things make more money. We're looking at place attachment and place identity around the space and how that facilitates social cohesion. We're looking at how it improves public safety through some of those methods, and the timing of our village is actually targeted to address public safety. So those are some of the things that we're looking at now.
Mm. Which become really hard data in that now. So I had someone over, we're going over here. So this gentleman here and the lady over there, but there was still someone over here, this lady here as well. So.
Hello, my name's Brian. I work for the EU Commission on Climate Change. So Deanna, thanks very much for your talk. And we're working up with cities and communities to help them kind of change the infrastructure and the way we use buildings, of course, to drive to the low carbon society. And I'm just hearing you and I'm thinking there must be a lot of parallels or learnings from how you've used design and how you've engaged communities to also take us on that journey more quickly to the transition we need to make in cities. So I'm just wondering, what do you think we need to do? What can we learn from your work that could also help us in engaging with communities on making this transition quicker to the low carbon economy?
No, know, it's interesting, the low carbon economy piece, or at least we'll talk about sort of environmental sustainability piece, is something that we have been trying to build into our projects and help people understand and pay for, right? So there's a cost right now. I mean, the cost benefit argument can of course be made, but the upfront cost to transition to a low, you know, low carbon community is hard. In a lot of the communities where we're working, where people are dying every day, and it's a really heavy lift. And so one of the things I'm hoping that will come out of the data collection piece that we're doing with communities, empowering them that way, particularly through the Restore of Justice City Reinvestment Tool, which we are really working now in Detroit to do, is to have communities identify the data that they want to collect and then be able to use that to make change. Now, whether that be about environmental criteria, whether it be about education, whether that be about public safety, but starting to get them to collect it and use it to empower and provide agency to move things forward in their community. And I'm not, you know, we're looking at it through public safety right now, but it actually can expand into a lot other things. This was also a resiliency tool, has been recognized as a risk mitigation strategy around resiliency. And we are, part of the programming in the village is around sustainable economy, sustainable agriculture. So you saw them holding up the vegetable, the fruit. I think she was holding up a yam or something, but there's a huge educational component within, built into the infrastructure of this, that is helping communities to think a little differently. And understand that through this education, through learning about these things, they can kind of take control of certain systems that have been not serving them. And I don't know if that answers your question, but I know that we are working on the environmental sustainability aspects of our work over and its intersectionality with the social sustainability pieces.
Lady in the red coat, and I've clocked you. I'm seeing we've got time. We'll come back to you.
Thanks for the talk. Very inspiring. And I think it sent a message of hope for everyone here in the room. I've come from the online courts forum, the first of its kind around the world today. And the message that was coming from representatives from jurisdictions around the world was an emphasis on user-centered design as they look to take their services online. My question is, are you working with the courts service? How are you integrating this with the work that they're doing? And where do you see the future of online court services on the basis of your experience so far?
So, we have not worked with the courts very much. The Center for Court Innovation is the primary court-based group that we worked in. They are a think tank coming out of the New York City court system, and they are doing a lot of community court development work. And so they're almost the opposite of the online courts piece, in that they're in the community, like these are community-driven, and there's like sort of, rather than send people to jail, they're doing various things in the community. So those are the groups that we've been working with, this sort of more grassroots piece. The New Law Lab out of Boston is a think tank that we have been in talks with around their online court system and also training on how to deal and address courts. But those are sort of early sort of ideas about what that can do through a digital medium, like through active engagement, like, you know, how do I even engage with the system? What do I do as a sort of a learning tool and gamifying that? So that's one thing that we've talked to them about. We also, the Justice Mapping Center, who we're doing the Restorative Justice City Reinvestment Tool with, is really building that out to include court-based procedures in there so you can kind of see what the courts are doing. So it's not for, you know, I'm not going online to engage in a court system, but we're working with various lawyers, and he has a safety audit, a sort of citywide safety audit tool that he's developing in Chicago now, and he did it recently in Indonesia to sort of help folks understand where money is being spent and what the outcomes or sort of court processes are, laid over police activity, layered over a lot of things. So that's where we have been intersecting with that sector mostly.
They're really stretching you tonight, this audience.
I love it. The push is good.
Yeah, we always get a clever bunch.
Afterwards.
So we had the lady here. And then I have two at the back, and the lady there, and then I think we'll probably be at our limit.
My question is about kind of when you're going into these communities that are marginalised, that have histories of violence and trauma, when you are going in and first proposing building the kind of restorative justice centre and so on, when you're approaching these communities at first, did you find that you were experiencing any resistance or scepticism from them? And how did you get them to really engage with the ideas that you're proposing?
There's almost always scepticism any time we're moving into a new community. And we never do it unless we have community partners that really trust us and who the community trusts. It's the only way to do it. And that we usually do that by showing up a lot. Like, you just keep seeing our little faces at their events. We go to the events that they're having. We spend time with them. We talk to them. We listen to them. It is a long game. You know, it's not a quick drop parachute in and then walk on out. All these projects you're seeing have taken years just to get to the point that we are now. And we make mistakes sometimes, and we have to recover quickly from that as best we can. I think that we do a very good job of listening to the community, and we also really, we deeply respect their wisdom. But we can't, and often they suggest the projects, right? It's not, we always come like, I've got something for you. You know, they are the ones who understand and know what the projects need to be. And that's why we like the Restorative Justice City investment tool process, because it really helps communities identify the projects that they need to build, rather than the government telling them what we need to build and then building it.
Okay, so I think we're the neighbours talking to him, so pass it on to your next guy. Hi. Next.
I'm just kind of follows on to that last question in terms of how scalable your work has been. So how much one intervention works in one community, but also around digitization. You spoke about a lot of human trauma and how much that's probably a very personal process, and how that works when it's digitized, how successful it is.
Are you referring to a specific project that I showed, or is there...
Yeah, I think you mentioned that your toolkit was being digitized so it could reach a wider audience, but then I was wondering how successful that's been in terms of the results as well.
Yeah, we are just moving, we're just finishing up the curriculum, and it hasn't gone into beta testing yet. So when it does, but that's something we have talked about, right? That question that you're asking, if I'm seeing trauma coming up in the face-to-face piece, what's going to happen when I'm by myself on the apparatus, and we're starting to ask some of that stuff. So we have tried to modify it a little bit. We are working with, you know, the institutions that it's going into will know that that's the curriculum on there, and there may be able to provide some kind of support. But it is something we're going to be tracking pretty closely, because the last thing we want to do is activate folks and then not have the support around it. So far, so good. In the moment when that's happened in some of our workshops, we've just been able to hold space for them, and they've been able to process and move through it. And it's also been working. We generally tend to work with incarcerated populations where there's a program in place that supports it already. And so it may be just making sure that we're tied into the existing programming inside of the institution.
And there being a kind of infrastructure for restorative justice helps that, in that that's understanding that trauma will show up is something that's kind of built into that system a bit more. Yeah. Gentleman beside him.
My question is, I'm over here.
Thank you.
My question is really a follow-up to that and a few other conversations, and it's about the value of space and the value of place, particularly in the kind of emerging wake of digitization. And just to kind of give a bit of background about myself, my name's Simon, I was a researcher on the UK law courts since the 1970s, just down the road at the LSE, and now I'm an urban planner at Foster and Partners, so it's, your presentation had so many synergies with the things that I'm really passionate about, right? So, but I think the one thing which has always rung true through all projects and pieces of research is actually, you know, particularly with more complicated issues, the value of face-to-face interaction is absolutely fundamental, and though I do agree with traditional there are some elements of traditional justice which are, you know, really well suited to digitization, because traditional justice is difficult. You have to get all the right people in the room at the right time with the right evidence, and that's increasingly challenging in a kind of international world. But I was just really interested to hear your reflections on the value of place, because it seems to be so important throughout all of your projects.
Well, for us the place piece is really about creating environments where community can get built and sustained. You know, if we go to a lot of communities, there really people just have nowhere to go. And I'm curious about the intersectionality of this sort of reliance on digital space when you're working in communities where there is no place for them to go. There's no place for young people to go. I mean, really nowhere. They can either be in homes that are often not safe for them. I don't know. I was in a school in the Bronx, Brooklyn, the other day. Horrible. Looked like a prison. And there's nowhere for them to be. So they're trying to develop space. And the fact that our environment, we know through environmental design, that our environment actually can reduce our heart rate. It can calm us down. It can reduce violence. It does things for us. And a lot of communities working don't even have that kind of environment. And then the social cohesion piece is really important for safety. It's important for our health and wellness, for our psychological health and wellness. So that's what we believe the power of space can do, that it can help our communities thrive, and it is actually a critical piece to sustainability. And we use digital stuff too. I'm always like, how do we use the tool to support the transformation? And we have a bunch of digital tools that we're using. As a matter of fact, the Peace Play tool is going to be a self-soothing tool, a digital self-soothing tool for young people, because they like that, and it's a good entree into teaching restorative justice that will allow them to self-soothe and then move into a circle. But then we're going to build the space that they create, right? So we're actually going to then make it. So we're not going to stay in the digital, we're going to move it to the physical, because we think it's that important that it just can't stay in the digital realm.
We're really making you work. We have one last question, and then we're just about on time, so over to you.
Thank you. It's always great to hear more examples of work that is working towards ending mass incarceration. And that's obviously a really important part of the work towards prison abolition as a strategy and practice. So I wondered, first, whether you conceive of your work as being prison abolitionist, and your philosophy as well. And second, how you apply the principles of prison abolition in your government, in the governance of your organizations and projects.
So I would say that in my heart, I'm a prison abolitionist. I have to work in a lot of very contentious spaces, so I don't scream that in the thing. But I think I would hope one day that we could see the end of those. We do not design prisons or jails or courthouses in my organization. We do not participate in that. We don't ever touch that. And we get asked on a regular basis to participate. We don't ever participate at any level in the development of that infrastructure. And that is primarily how we bring that into our practice. You know, other than that, there are other just general awareness practices that we do in my organization, that we understand what's happening and what, you know, where we are placed within that. And we're very clear with folks about that. And it's less of an occurrence, but on a regular basis, on a weekly basis, I have to have that conversation around why we're not going to participate in that. And speak with other organizations. I've been to speak with architecture firms about their justice division in their organization and what they need to be doing to get themselves away from that. And so that's always an ongoing conversation with people.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Deanna. This has been an incredible, I mean, we really made you work as well. There was a lot
that's
of questions.
Okay. That's okay. Good. Amazing questions, amazing.
But thank you so much for an incredibly inspiring talk,
thank
something
you.
That touches on so many different lines of work and sort of the work that we're interested in around systemic change, but also around restorative justice and the criminal justice system. So we want a long-term relationship in which we continue to find out more about your work. We're delighted that you're this year's bicentenary medalist. If you didn't get a chance to have a question, you know, there's more discussion to be had downstairs because we've got some drinks downstairs in the Benjamin Franklin room. We could also probably do a big round of singing happy birthday. but will you finally join me in thanking Deanna Van Buren for her excellent bicentenary medal address?
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.